BCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at bcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
February brings a very special observance to the United States, Black History Month, a time to recognize the contributions of Black Americans to our nation's history, as well as the many struggles endured to see equality exercised toward all. Today's Crosstalk is a very special broadcast as we look into our archives to revisit a past VCY rally titled Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. The speaker was William Federer. Federer, who has published multiple books regarding America's history, particularly America's Christian roots. And he's a longtime favorite to Crosstalk listeners. Now, time does not allow for us to air the rally in its entirety. However, near the end of today's Crosstalk, we will share the information that you will need to obtain a DVD copy for yourself. I'm Dalton Windsor, in for Jim Schneider. And now, from that VCY rally held in February of 2003 in the Milwaukee suburb of Waukesha, Wisconsin, let's listen together as William Federer presents Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values.
This is Dr. Ben Carson. Now, Dr. Ben Carson is the head of neurological surgery at Johns Hopkins University. This is one of the most prestigious positions in the entire medical field. And he started off in Detroit, grew up. His mother was one of 24 children, and she was married when she was 13 and had two children, and later found out that the husband had another wife across town, and so she divorced him. And so she had their two child that she was raising on her own, and she would work all kinds of hours and not have time, and they'd end up watching television, and they would get into trouble. And so Ben had a terrible temper and would go to school and didn't know any of the answers. And by fifth grade, he had the reputation of being a dummy. So his mom, Sonia, decided that no more TV. And so when they would come home from school, she would walk them the seven blocks to the public library, and she would have them read books and write a book report for her. And at first, Ben thought this was child abuse. And finally, he started liking it. And one of the corners were turned when he was in class one day, and the teacher held up a rock and said, "Does anybody know what kind of rock this is?" And nobody knew. And he looked at it and he said, "It's obsidian." And all the other kids in the class look at him, and he wasn't called dummy after that anymore. And he began to do book reports for his mom. Now, years later, he realized that his mom couldn't even read. And she was having him do this, and they'd hand him the book reports, and she'd look at it, but she couldn't even read it. Now, she since has gone on, and she's got her college degree. But this is the background that he was in. The Lord was somebody that was very important in his life. When studies overwhelmed Ben and his brother, Sonia, the mother, would say, "You weren't born to be a failure. You can do it. You just ask the Lord, and He will help you." At age 8, Ben had a missionary speak at church, and Ben made up his mind that he wanted to be a missionary doctor. His mother's reaction was, "Well, Benny, you will be a doctor." Becoming a doctor would demand a fine education, which Sonia didn't find in the local schools. It didn't matter if the children weren't made to learn their multiplication tables in schools. She made them learn them at home. Two things were working in his favor. One was his strong faith in God that continued to sustain him, and the other was the mother who got involved in his life and believed in him, a mother who prayed for wisdom to go beyond her own third grade education in order to instill in her son the enthusiasm for learning. Her prayers led her to a plan that worked. He went on to go to high school. He eventually earned a scholarship to Yale University, went on to medical school at the University of Michigan. By age 33, he had earned his current position as director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins University. And ladies and gentlemen, he is the youngest man ever to hold this position. Extremely distinguished title. He performs over 500 critical operations on children in dire need each year, which is over triple the normal neurosurgeon. And in 1987, Dr. Carson did a brand new world-shaking surgery by separating two Siamese twins, the Bender twins, who were joined at the head, at the skull, and they shared a vein that was a vital vein for bringing blood out of the brain, and both of the Siamese twins had that same vein. And all the doctors were saying, well, one of these is going to have to die. Well, he spent 5 months planning the surgery. It was a 22-hour surgery, and guess what? Both of them survived. And it made world news. Tremendous impact. And this is what he said. When asked how he stayed focused, he said, it's a matter of constantly being in the correct state of mind. The first thing I do is pray. Then I read from the Bible, the book of Proverbs, which has an enormous amount of wisdom. Just give me wisdom to know what to do and what not to do, states the humble physician. Dr. Carson shares his wisdom in several outstanding books. One is Gifted Hands, and another is Think Big. And he's the recipient of 21 honorary doctorates. And he's been written up in Parade Magazine, Reader's Digest, New York Times, Fortune Magazine, and he's right there in Baltimore, Maryland. His book, Think Big, the think stands for T, talent, H, honesty, I, insight, N, nice, K, knowledgeable, B, books, I, in-depth learning, and G, God. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a tremendous American, a tremendous human being, and an inspiration to each and every one of us. And I want to thank God for Dr. Ben Carson. Now, another one of my heroes is Dr. Alan Keyes. Dr. Alan Keyes was the ambassador to the UN for President Ronald Reagan. He spent 11 years in the U.S. State Department. And we have Colin Powell that's in there right now and Condoleezza Rice, great African-American leaders. But Alan Keyes served in the U.S. Foreign Service and was the staff at the National Security Council before becoming Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the U.N. Economic and Social Council. He represented the interests of the United States in the U.N. General Assembly from 1983 to 1985. And in 1985, he was appointed Assistant Secretary of State for international organizations. He was the head of Citizens Against Government Waste, and he was the founder of National Taxpayers Action Day. He was the two-time Republican nominee for the United States Senate in the state of Maryland. Now, I was honored because I got, in my speaking across the country, people would organize events, and they would have me speak, and they would have Alan Keyes speak. And I had the opportunity of introducing him several times. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored to speak before Alan Keyes speaks, but I will never speak after he speaks because he is the most powerful, captivating speaker since Frederick Douglass. And after he's done, the room gets quiet and everybody is so convicted and you feel the presence of the Holy Spirit. Dr. Alan Keyes got his doctorate from Harvard. He wrote his dissertation on constitutional theory. He's the intern president of Alabama A&M University in 1991. He speaks French and Spanish and a little Russian and a little ancient Greek and is the author of Masters of the Dream, The Strength and Betrayal of Black America, 1995, and Our Character, Our Future, Reclaiming America's Moral Destiny. And he's unashamedly and consistently raises the standard of unalienable rights in biblical truth, in defense of the unborn, and for civil rights. You know, one of the things I love about Dr. Alan Keyes is he has taken the Declaration apart and studied it backwards and forwards, and the points in there is all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. All men, no matter which race, no matter which country, all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that Declaration goes on to mention God several more times. It talks about laws of nature and of nature's God. It says, relying on the protection of divine providence and the supreme ruler. And it refers to God four times. And here we are in a country where they're wanting to take God out of everything. And so Dr. Alan Keyes started a Declaration Foundation. The most inspiring, godly Christian man who not only stands up for race, for equality, but stands up for God and the unborn, which takes a tremendous amount of courage. Another leader is Clarence Thomas. I want to read to you an article written by Paul Weyrich, who's the head of Free Congress Foundation. And Paul Weyrich writes this: Clarence Thomas is slowly but surely becoming one of the most influential of the nine jurists on the U.S. Supreme Court, whose opinions today have so much to do with the conduct of our government as well as our daily lives. No Supreme Court justice in history has had to endure the constant vilification which Thomas has. He has chosen to ignore what was said about him in favor of long hours and hard work on cases assigned to him. He told me, and this is to Paul Weyrich, that his greatest satisfaction in being on the Supreme Court is the ability to eventually bring his colleagues around to a sound point of view by doing solid work. Ever since he was confirmed in 1991, 52 to 48, Clarence Thomas has been determined to outlive his critics, not just by serving longer on the court, but by becoming, through solid historical work, a respected force. Nothing has shaken him from this goal. Some justices have their clerks do all the writing. They merely outline their views, and the clerks do the rest of the work. Clarence Thomas, on the other hand, doesn't let others do for him the most important work of the court. He labors personally at writing the material himself. What has become clear is that as a result of his labors, the other justices now regard him as a keen intellect whose opinions have always been backed by excellent research. Now it is his critics who have begun to look foolish, as Thomas is emerging as a powerful voice on the court. His logic is powerful, his research impeccable. Now his influence with his colleagues is steadily increasing. Thomas is a model for anyone who has endured false criticism and demands the same sort of crowd in which, in Christ's time, shouted, "Give us Barabbas." Even among those he considers close friends, Thomas never lets his critics frame how he looks on things. He knows God, and he lets God determine the framework for his overall thinking. Beyond that, Thomas sticks to the Constitution, the minds of those who framed it, and as he labors through the myriad of issues which those who wrote the Constitution could ever have imagined. He has every right to be bitter, but he is anything but bitter. The reason his critics get more angry is because it is beginning to dawn on them that they have no effect on Thomas. And that's Supreme Court Justice and African-American Clarence Thomas.
That's the voice of Bill Federer from the 2003 VCY rally titled "Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values." Today's broadcast, a reminder that February is Black History Month, recognizing the contributions and the struggles that many endured to see equality for all. Time doesn't allow for us to air the entire 90-minute presentation. However, near the end of Crosstalk today, we will share the information on how to obtain a DVD copy. There is plenty more ahead when Crosstalk continues here on the VCY America Radio Network.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, geologist and president of the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, does the fossil record prove evolution?
Not at all, Chris. In fact, it couldn't prove evolution because evolution didn't happen. I don't even think it supports evolution very well. What we see in the fossil record are the same kinds of plants and animals which are alive today. They can be put in the various categories such as clams or snails or brachiopods. Some animals, like the dinosaurs, have gone extinct, but none of the fossils seem to point to one type of animal evolving or changing into another type. That's because evolution simply didn't happen. What did happen is creation. Creation of the basic types of plants and animals that God created. They exist into the present day or else have gone extinct, but nothing else has arisen since then. And that's the way it is back in Genesis.
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called "That's a Fact." Call us at 800-628-7640 and mention the promo code FACT.
Welcome back. If you just joined us today, we have went back into our archives to revisit a VCY rally titled Black Americans Who Have Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. This in observance of February's National Black History Month, recognizing the contributions and struggles endured that all might live free. By the way, near the end of Crosstalk today, we will share the information of how you can order this entire VCY presentation on CD or DVD, so have a pen and paper ready. And now, time for more from that VCY rally with Bill Federer.
Another one of my heroes is J.C. Watts. And I was just with him this past week and actually did a radio show with him. We talked about George Washington Carver. And he said, you know, Bill, I got a chance to meet one of the Carver boys. See, George Washington Carver disciples students. And there was a group of them that he spent some extra time with. And J.C. Watts said, yeah, I went to visit Mr. Grisham in Bethany, Oklahoma. He's 91 years old now. And I got a chance to go over to his house and just to listen to him talk about Dr. Carver and what a great Christian man he was. But J.C. Watts was the University of Oklahoma star quarterback football player, and he led his team to two Orange Bowl victories and was named the Orange Bowl Most Valuable Player. And then he went to play professional football with the Canadian League and was named the Most Valuable Player up there. Then he came back to Oklahoma and worked with his dad, who was a pastor, and he became a youth minister, an ordained Christian minister, and very effective. And then he decides to run for Congress. And in 1994, he gets elected to the United States Congress in a district that's 80% white. He is so respected in Congress that he gets voted the House Conference Chairman, which is, ladies and gentlemen, the fourth most important position in our government. The House Conference Chairman is the one that, in the case of the Republicans, all the Republican congressmen meet on a side room of the Capitol before they go out onto the main floor. And they discuss what they're going to do and what their game plan is. J.C. Watts chaired the committee. He's the one that stood there and called, okay, you get to speak now, and you get to speak now, and you don't get to, I mean, and twice I was in that meeting, and J.C. Watts called me up to the front and gave me the microphone, and I got to speak to all the congressmen, Dennis Hastert, Dick Armey, Tom DeLay, Tom Davis, and he allowed me to be able to address the leadership of our country. J.C. Watts, he came to St. Louis when I was running for office and spoke for me. And just a great leader. And ladies and gentlemen, I think he just decided, he said, Bill, when I ran for Congress, I said that I was going to run for three terms. He said, I ran four. And he says, I want to spend time with my family. He says, my son's got his basketball season now, and I got to drive him to the basketball games. And so he's back in Oklahoma, and he just wrote a book. And the title of the book is, What Color is a Conservative? Brilliant book from a brilliant man. And I think it's important that we as Americans and all Americans realize the contribution of men like J.C. Watts, Alan Keyes, Clarence Thomas, and all the great leaders, Dr. Ben Carson. And I want to give J.C. a hand. And he's such a strong Christian. Now, how many of you have been down to Tuskegee? Well, if you ever go down there, they have the museum where they have Dr. Carver's, George Washington Carver's, all of his microscopes and all of his things and inventions and plants and samples of food and so forth. But on the side, there's a little theater, and in the theater, you get to watch a movie, and it's the movie of the Tuskegee Airmen. It's a very inspiring story of these pilots, African-American pilots, and the struggles they went through to become pilots. And then, in the war, working through a military system that wasn't going to put them in a place where they could fight, But they were all trained for it, and then finally they got the open door, and they got to go over to North Africa, and then they got to fly in Europe, and they got a reputation of being the best of flying and being trustworthy. And when the big bombers that were slow had to have planes accompany and defend them, the Tuskegee Airmen were the ones that were requested to be the ones protecting the convoy of those airplanes. Harriet Tubman. Now, I felt it's important that we look at great African-American women as well. Harriet Tubman was born in 1819 or 1820. We don't know, because she was born a slave and they didn't keep the records. And she was in Dorchester County, Maryland. And when she was 12 years old, she was seriously injured by a blow to the head from an overseer because she refused to tie up another slave who had attempted to escape. You know, there were terrible injustices that were done, and it breaks my heart to see these, to read these stories of the injustices that were done. Well, she was given a piece of paper by a white neighbor with two names on it and told how to find the house that she could escape to. And she went to that house. At the first house, she was put into a wagon covered with a sack and driven to her next destination. Following this route to Pennsylvania, she initially settled in Philadelphia, where she met William Still, a Philadelphia station manager on the Underground Railroad. With his assistance, they formed the Philadelphia Anti-Slavery Society and began working with the Underground Railroad. In 1851, she began relocating members of her family to Ontario, Canada, and then in the operations until 1857. After freeing herself from slavery, Harriet Tubman had the courage to go back into Maryland and into America and to rescue members of her family, and she eventually conducted over 300 people to freedom. 300 people to freedom, and she risked her life because they had the Democrats had just passed the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850, and it was, if you are caught harboring or a slave, then you are punished. And so they wanted to turn people in. So she was risking her life. And the story says that she was pretty tough. And she knew that if she was helping somebody to escape and they got afraid and went back, that they could get forced to tell where the Underground Railroad was and they'd all get in trouble. And so she told them, she says, if you're going to come with me, you have to be willing to not turn back or die. And she told them, she said, if we get halfway there and you decide to turn back, and she let them know pretty strong that she might be the one to shoot them, you know? So thank God for women with some backbone, too. A great leader. And she had a U.S. postage stamp made with her image on it. These are inspiring stories. They happened right here in America. Another one is Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth was born a slave, and she was able to get free, and when she did, she prayed and went to the Lord and asked the Lord. She said, I didn't want to have any of Egypt on me. And so not only did I leave all the trappings of Egypt behind, but I left my name behind. This is what she said. When I left the house of bondage, I left everything behind. I wanted to keep nothing of Egypt on me, so I went to the Lord and asked him to give me a new name. I set up under a banner, and then I sing. And I tell the folks that come around to listen, and then I tell them about Jesus. She was a Christian. A Christian woman that went around from upstate New York. She was born in 1797. She had four masters until the 4th of July, 1827, when slavery was finally abolished in the state of New York. It was 1827 that New York ended slavery. Then She took the courageous court action of demanding the return of her youngest son, Peter, who had been illegally sold away from her to a slave owner in Alabama. And she moved to New York City. She was able to get her son back. She was deeply religious. And I love it because every biography you read on Sojourner Truth, she was so sold out to the Lord that even histories that are written that don't like to talk about religion, they have to mention religion because she was so touched and so open about it. She became a traveling preacher, and she all the way from Long Island to Connecticut, speaking to people on the countryside about her life and her relationship with God. She was a powerful speaker and a powerful singer. When she rose to speak, wrote one observer, her commanding figure and dignified manner hushed every trifler in the audience to silence. Audiences were melted into tears by her touching stories. After several months of traveling, Truth was encouraged by friends to go to Northampton Association, which had been founded in 1841 as a cooperative community dedicated to abolitionism. And there she met one of the thinkers, William Lloyd Garrison. And just last week, I met a descendant of William Lloyd Garrison and was able to give him a copy of my book on George Washington Carver. Sojourner Truth met President Lincoln in the White House. And President Lincoln told her that he had heard her speeches long before. So here was a woman who made an impact on the President of the United States. Thank God for a woman filled with the Holy Ghost and being willing to stand up for truth and to risk her life to help free her brothers and sisters from slavery.
The message is titled, Black Americans Who Have Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. The speaker, a St. Louis native, William Federer, the best-selling author, historian, and a favorite here to Crosstalk listeners. Bill's presentation is from our VCY archives going back to February 2003. February marks the national observance of Black History Month, which is also observed in Canada, the United Kingdom, Germany, and in the Netherlands. Now, we are up against the break, and we're only halfway through. Plus, we will also need to tell you how you can own your own CD or DVD copy of today's presentation for yourself or to share with a friend. And we'll have that information for you near the end of this hour. By the way, are you new to Crosstalk? Crosstalk is heard on over 100 radio outlets across America and worldwide online. Crosstalk covers the issues that affects our world, nation, our families, our churches, and it's all done through a biblical perspective. Whatever the topic, the Bible remains the authority, the written, unchanging, inerrant, infallible Word of God. And now for over 30 years, Crosstalk continues bringing solid information to the body of Christ. I'm Dalton Windsor, in for Jim Schneider today. Stay with us as there is plenty more ahead here on the VCY America Radio Network. Our society is being influenced by the entertainment media, and we don't even realize it. Why is it that many Christians entertain themselves by watching movies or programs that take God's name in vain, or feature sensual activity on Saturday night, and then go to church on Sunday to praise His name? That's the underlying message in the DVD, Power of the Air by Dave Cristiano. This moving story features a missionary from Africa who warns that the church in America is being deceived and in great danger. A Christian that hears this message is convicted and makes a significant change in his life and sets out a plan to reach his city with the gospel. Watch this story unfold in the DVD, Power of the Air, available now for a donation of $18, with additional copies available for a donation of just $10 more. Call 1-800-729-9829. Crosstalk continues here across the VCY America Radio Network. And, you know, it is February. February brings a very special observance to not only us here in the United States, but to other nations as well. Black History Month. It's a time to recognize the many contributions of Black Americans to our nation's history, as well as the many struggles that were endured to see equality exercised toward all. And this is a very special broadcast today as we look back into our VCY America archives to revisit a past rally, a rally that was titled Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. The speaker was William Federer, or Bill Federer, as many refer to him as. And here in this segment, Bill lays out somewhat of a background on why slavery was and continued to be a problem here in America up until the time of the Civil War.
A little bit of history. In 1619, the first Dutch ship carrying slaves came up the James River in Virginia. 1619. Well, in Massachusetts, a slave trading ship tried to come up, and the Puritans and the Pilgrims were so upset at this, they took the captain of the slave ship and threw him in jail and arrested him, and they took the ship and they returned all the slaves back to Africa. And you begin to see that there is two different threads that run throughout the history of our country. On the one side of abolition, in 1732, Oglethorpe, that founded Georgia, in his original writings, he forbade slavery. In 1774, two of the colonies rejected slavery. And then you see some interesting writings, because some of the other colonies wrote laws to abolish slavery, but King George III vetoed them. King George III, they wanted to get rid of slavery, and King George III vetoed them. And that was one of the things that colonists were upset about that caused them to want to have the revolution against King George III. You see that there's underlying currents going on here. So the two colonies already backed away. When Thomas Jefferson wrote the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, the first draft got rid of slavery. It condemns King George III for 19 different things. He takes taxation without representation. You know, he incites the natives of the frontiers to attack us. And he imprisons people who have never offended him from a distant land and forces them to serve in slavery. And he impedes every single chance to try to free them. And that's listed by Thomas Jefferson as one of the reasons that we're rebelling against Britain. Well, guess what? A couple of the southern states said, we're not going to sign the Declaration as long as that's in there. And you and I wish that they would have had enough guts to stand their ground, but unfortunately, as much courage as they had, they didn't, and they backed away, and they went ahead and let those states erase that line out of the Declaration, and they came up with the Declaration we have now, which didn't eliminate slavery. Well, two of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, who helped start the American Bible Society, he helps found the first anti-slavery society. And guess who was the first president of the first anti-slavery society? Benjamin Franklin. Good old Ben Franklin. I mean, after he signed the Declaration, after he signed the Constitution, he dedicated the rest of his life to fighting slavery. Another one was Henry Lee. Noah Webster fought slavery, the guy that wrote Webster's Dictionary. And also Livingston, who signed the Constitution, wanted to get rid of slavery. Then in 1783, they voted to eliminate slavery from America, and it fell short by one vote. Isn't that terrible? One vote, they fell short. Well, in 1796, the different colonies had drawn their lines, but there was this territory out to the west. So George Washington signed a law forbidding slavery in all the free territories in 1796. And George Washington wrote in his will that all of his slaves were freed upon the death of his wife. Now, we wish he would have freed him right then, and several did free him right then, but he didn't have any kids to take care of his wife, and I guess he felt like he needed to do that. But he did free one of his slaves right then, who was my mulatto man, William, who was faithfully with me all his life and whose leg got injured in something. And he says that he's free, but he can stay here. And if he does stay here, we'll support him for the rest of his life. And but that was George Washington. Then we sort of see the lines develop. In the South, the Democrat Party passed through the Missouri Compromise. And the Missouri Compromise said that, you know, from now on, if new states want to come into the Union, we have to have a slave state come in the same time that a free state comes in. See, before then, when the guys that did the Declaration, they thought, well, slavery's on its way out. You know, pretty soon it's just going to sort of die out. But with that, and then the Fugitive Slave Law, then the Dred Scott case, then the Kansas-Nebraska Act, all of a sudden they realized that, wait a second, those slave states want to grow. And they want to have more and more slave states in this. And that is when things began to heat up. And you read the speeches of Abraham Lincoln when he debated Stephen Douglas. And you can see that Abraham Lincoln hated slavery. You know, some people say, well, you know, he just declared the Emancipation Proclamation because of financial reasons or whatever. Well, you read Lincoln's views, he hated it. Even writing letters to Joshua Speed, a friend of his, he says, that trip we took down the Mississippi River and I saw those black men and women in chains on the steamboat going down to New Orleans, he says, that picture haunts my mind. And when he debated Stephen Douglas, Lincoln would get up there and condemn slavery, and Stephen Douglas would get up and he says, slavery is wrong, slavery is terrible, but it's a free country and everyone should have a free choice as to whether or not to own a slave. Isn't that terrible? Sounds like sort of a pro-choice argument we have today. Well, in 1856, back then there were two parties in America. There was the Democrat Party that was South and was pro-slavery, and there was the Whigs, W-H-I-G-S. And the Whigs wanted to be the big tent party. So they were sort of wishy-washy. They weren't for it. They weren't against it. They sort of wanted to hold the Union together. But people started getting fed up with the Whigs. And so in 1856, a new party was started. Called the Republican Party. And the original platform of the Republican Party said, we want to eliminate the two relics of barbarism, polygamy and slavery. And every single plank of the Republican Party since has been to eliminate slavery. And indeed, when the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves in the South, some people questioned, well, is that really legal for the president to just sign a little bill and make a law? And so they passed the 13th Amendment. And out of all of the amendments, the 13th Amendment is the only one signed by a president. It's signed by Abraham Lincoln. It would have gone into law without his signature. He didn't have to sign it, but he signed it to show that he is so enthusiastic about freeing the slaves and prohibiting slavery in all the states. Of all the Republican congressmen and senators that voted, 100% of the Republicans voted for the 13th and the 14th and the 15th Amendments. Very few Democrats voted for it. And that's just history. That's just a historical record. You and I, no matter which color we are, we've inherited this country. What are we going to do with it? Well, I'll tell you what. It's always a story of one or two people with courage that are willing to stand up and make a difference. Isn't that the way the Bible is? I mean, God told Gideon, you got 30,000 men against 300,000. You got too many. Tell the ones that are afraid to go home. So it whittles down to 3,000 men. And God says, Gideon, that's still too many men. And Gideon's like, 3,000 against 300,000 is still too many. He goes, yes. And so he said, tell them to go down by the creek and drink water. And those that bring it up to his mouth, you know, keep. And those that put their head in the water, you know, tell them to go home. Anyway, so it whittles down to 300. You know, little David against this 9-foot Goliath. Moses backed up against the Red Sea and Pharaoh charging in with these chariots going 30 miles an hour. You know, God somehow seems to always wait till something looks hopeless and he finds a couple men and women with courage against all odds that are willing to stand up and say, Lord, use me to make a difference. And I believe that these men and women that we're talking about throughout history are great African-American leaders in the past. They are inspirations to you and I today to say, yes, there's problems in America and there's problems in the world, but they're overwhelming. No, they're not overwhelming. You know, I'll just share something with you. If everything was perfect, and you lived your life and died and went to heaven, and you run into Moses and David and Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and these great leaders up there, and you say, tell us the story again. You know, what was it like, you know, the Underground Railroad and risking your life? And what was it like, you know, fighting Pharaoh? And they tell us these great inspiring stories. And then they say, Hugh, tell us, what did you do in your life? Tell us, and you want to say, well, everything was taken care of in my life. There wasn't anything to do. I mean, you're going to have to carry that story around forever where you go in heaven, you know? No, but guess what? God gave us lots to do. So when you get to heaven and people walk up to you, and you're in the great assembly, and they call you up on the stage and say, it's your turn to tell what you did in your life, and everybody's looking right at you, you can say, yes, I was living in a time when there were problems, when there were still prejudices in different areas. And, you know, we talk about slavery. There still is slavery going on in North Africa. There are missionary societies that are buying the Christian boys and girls that are enslaved by the northern Muslim tribes, and they're buying from the Muslims the Christians who have been enslaved. They're buying their freedom. It costs maybe about, you know, $3,000 to buy somebody. I talked to one organization that I heard that it was $175. They could buy the freedom for a little young girl. And what happens in Sudan today, the northern Muslim Sudanese have killed over 2 million Christians in southern Sudan. They have oil fields in the south, and in the north, the Sudanese have an oil company that's part owned by Chinese, part owned by some of the Arabs, and they want to clear these people off this land so that they can drill for their oil. And so big is this that a friend of mine, Brad Phillips, has lobbied Congress for these last several years, and he got every one of the congressmen, 435 black and white, Democrat, Republican, to sign on to a bill to not do business with North Sudan until they stop punishing and killing the southern Sudanese Christians. And President Reagan signed it into law just a few months ago. Yes. President Bush, what did I say? It's these bright lights shining in my eyes. See, those are the listening on the radio. I'm up here with these bright lights in my head. It causes my brain to go on the blink. But President Bush signed it. And also, the problem with AIDS in Africa. That's a crisis that's looking for an answer. And you and I can make a difference in that.
That's Bill Federer speaking at a past VCY America rally titled Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. Bill's final segment is just ahead, so stay with us. We will also be sharing the information that you will need to obtain a CD or DVD copy of this rally for yourself. If not for you, maybe to share with a friend. Today's broadcast, a reminder that February is Black History Month, recognizing the contributions, the many contributions, and the struggles that many endured to see equality for everyone. So, don't get too far from your radio. We'll be back with our final segment of today's special broadcast with Bill Federer. It's on the VCY America Radio Network.
For the Worldview Week in Minute, I'm Brandon House. Our website's worldviewradio.com. We're sad to announce the passing of our friend Phil Haney, former Department of Homeland Security whistleblower, who wrote the book See Something, Say Nothing. Phil's TV show was filmed in our TV studio, and it was called National Security Meltdown. It was to be the basis of a new book, and we understand there are some things that were going to be in that book that would not, have set well with some folks. We know he kept files and records. He openly spoke about this at our conferences and knew who it was that were deleting files from the Department of Homeland Security database related to jihadis. He was investigated many times. They convened grand juries against him. And he told us many times the same people after Donald Trump were the same people after him, the same deep state actors. The death is very suspicious, and it is being investigated by many of his friends, many of them who are former law enforcement. So pray for Phil's family, and we honor Phil Haney.
We're back on Crosstalk across the VCY America radio network. We have been listening to a rally an archive rally from February of 2003 when the special guest speaker was Bill Federer. His presentation titled, Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. Now on today's program, Bill spoke of several influential personalities, the likes of Booker T. Washington and many more, but he's about to get his most detailed description about someone we know, George Washington Carver. And we conclude this special broadcast today with just a portion of what Bill had to say as he told George Washington Carver's story. Let's listen together.
When he was born in 1865, slavery was just ending, and his dad had belonged to the next farm over, Mr. Grant's farm, and the dad died in a log hauling accident when they were carrying logs out of the woods, and he slipped and fell under the wheels. So he never met his dad. And when he was still an infant, there were bushwhackers going through southwestern Missouri. Jesse James, ever heard of Jesse James? Well, he was a Confederate soldier, and when the war was over, he liked the shooting and so forth. And well, there were groups of people that sort of took law into their own hands, and they would go around and they would go to farms, and especially if it was a Union sympathizing farm. And so they went to the Carver farm to try to rob them. And one of the things they did was they hung up Moses Carver. He was a German immigrant with his wife Susan. They were childless. He hung him up by his thumbs to try to torture him to get him to tell where the treasure was hidden. Well, they didn't have any treasure, and so the bushwhackers took Mary and little baby George and a sister, and they fled to North Arkansas. Well, they cut Moses Carver down, and he sends a friend out with his best horse to go chase after him, and the next day they catch him in northern Arkansas, and they say, look, you know, just give us him back, and we'll give you this horse, and his best racehorse. And they say, well, tie the horse to the fence and leave, and we'll bring him back. So they tie the horse and leave. When they come back, there's no mom, there's no daughter. All there is, lying in a blanket, dying of whooping cough, is little baby George. He's as good as dead, thin, skinny. They pick him up, and they bring him back to Moses and Susan. Moses and Susan raise him as their own. They don't have children. And they have George and his older brother, Jim. Jim was healthy, and so he worked with Moses out in the fields, and George was sickly, so he stayed in the house with Susan, and she taught him how to read, taught him how to cook, taught him how to sew, taught him how to iron, taught him how to crochet, all these little tasks that later in life would become invaluable to him. When he was free time, he would go into the woods, and he'd collect little weeds, you know, and he'd build his own little garden. And he says sometimes many tears he would shed when he'd break the roots of one of his pets. He called his little plants pet. But he developed a green thumb. And so much that the other farmers, when they had plants that were sick, they'd either, you know, bring them to little George or have George come and look at their farm, and he'd tell them, well, you need to, you know, do this or that. And he became known as a little plant doctor. When he was 11 years old, he went into town in Neosho with Moses to pick up supplies, and he noticed a bunch of African-American children lined up in front of a house, and he goes, what's that? And he says, oh, that's a school for Negro children. And he says, I want to go there. So he goes back home, and they pray about it. They've always encouraged him to learn, and so she cooks him a bunch of loaves of bread, and he goes into town, into Neosho, and goes to the school there. And the first night, he sleeps in a loft of a barn, and the next day, he's taken in by Aunt Mariah and Uncle Andy Watkins, who were a childless black couple. She gave him his first Bible, which he cherished and carried with him always. And George would go around town and do odd jobs for people to raise money to pay for his grade school education. Now, can you imagine that? How many of you have children? I mean, can you imagine an 11-year-old child, orphan, going around town, knocking on doors, to earn money to pay for his grade school? Well, 2.5 years, he learns all that Schoolmaster Foster can teach him. So he hitches a ride with the family going to Fort Scott, Kansas. He lives in a lean-to behind a stagecoach depot. And then he cooks for a wealthy family in town. And they let him live underneath their back porch. And then he earns money to go pay for his high school education. And he witnessed a lynching there. So he experienced that terrible prejudice in his own life. Then he fled to another town, Payola in Olathe, Kansas, and he would open up a little laundry, or he would do odd jobs, and he became this industrious, and finally graduated from high school, and went to apply to Highland College, and he got accepted. to college. So he goes back to Neosho, and he shows his acceptance letter to college. Here he's so proud of himself, you know, started with nothing and went out on the road, and now he's accepted to college, and goes to, you know, shows everybody. And then he, when it's fall, it's time to go to college, he shows up at the university, and the president looks up from the desk and says, "Oh, I'm sorry, there's been a mistake. They don't let him in because of his race." Terrible. Anyway, dejected, he goes to Western Kansas. And he homesteads, which was a valuable experience for him because he learns what a farmer has to go through. And little did he know that later on he'd be the answer to prayer to lots of farmers. Then he went to Kansas City and he learned, went to a business school to learn typewriting and telegraph. You know, the dot, dot, dot. And he worked for the Union Telegraph Company. I mean, talk about industrious. Then he goes to Winterset, Iowa, and becomes the head cook at a hotel. In 1 year, I had saved enough money to take me to Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa, where I took art and music and college work. I opened a laundry here for my support. After all my matriculation fees had been paid, I had 10 cents worth of cornmeal and 5 cents worth of beef suet. I lived on these two things for a whole week. It took that long for people to learn that I wanted clothes to wash. After that week, I had many friends and plenty of work. I would never allow anyone to give me money, no difference how badly I needed it. I wanted literally to earn my living. Imagine that. He says, I remained here for 3 years, and his art teacher was Miss Etta Budd. And his paintings were so good that one of his paintings, the yucca plant, which was the plant he saw when he was in Western Kansas, went to the Chicago World's Fair in 1893 and got an honorable mention. Carver had a tremendous artistic gift. Well, Miss Etta Budd noticed how well he painted the plants, and she said, you know, you must really like plants. And he goes, well, yeah, I do. And she said, you know, you could help more people in agriculture than you can through painting. Why don't you go to Iowa State College of Agriculture, where my dad teaches? Well, she encouraged him. He went ahead to Iowa State College of Agriculture.
And well, that story continues, but we are out of time for Crosstalk today. The entire 90-minute presentation is available on CD or DVD and is titled Black Americans Who've Influenced America Toward Christ and Biblical Values. Thank you for listening. I'm Dalton Windsor, in for Jim Schneider. Keep a song in your heart, and may it be a song of praise.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.